This talk I called Now the Green Blade Rises, Agricultural Ministry in West Africa. I'm right now working as an ALC missionary in Senegal, which I'm going to start right out by showing you because so many people have asked me where it is. Senegal is this country here, the furthest west in West Africa. So as you can see, not all that clearly from this map, but it's not that far from New York. That's why I flew home for my vacation. I'm not even on a home leave, just on vacation here. And here in the whole village for a week. I've lived in Africa for 4.5 years now, and I'm really excited to be able to tell you about some of my impressions and some of what I've read. Many of you have probably seen the movie Out of Africa. Out of Africa and therefore the continent of Africa has been getting a lot of publicity lately. And many people have asked me what I thought about it. What I really liked and related to in the movie Out of Africa was the love that Karen Blixen had for the continent of Africa. You could really tell throughout all her experiences that she was crushed to have to leave because of illness, and that she really had this love for Africa and her life there. The only problem I have with it is that for me, Africa is people. Africa is the Africans, the people that live there. And as you may have noticed in that movie, there really weren't any strong African characters, and I think that was a great weakness of it. Also, unfortunately for me, the landscape where I live is nothing like the landscape that you saw there. That beautiful, beautiful grassland with wild animals and tall trees. As you can see from this map, which I hope most of you have realized by now is a more accurate projection of actual land area, Africa is an enormous continent, 3 times the size of the United States. We often don't think of it that big because of the old Mercator projection maps, which showed Europe in the center of things, and Africa is much smaller in relation. But it's actually a huge continent filled with variety, and Out of Africa certainly portrayed East Africa very beautifully, but where I live, it's more dry, dusty desert, as you'll see in the slides. And of course, the other problem is that I haven't seen Robert Redford yet. But we keep looking. But there are a lot of similarities in culture across Africa, even if there are so many differences in landscape. One of these similarities, which you can find all across Africa, is a very high value placed on family and family structure. I wanted to bring along this poster, which some of you may have seen, Lutheran World Federation put it out. It talks about a South African proverb, which goes, you can all read it, I'm sure, Umtu Ngumtu Ngambantu, something like that, which means a person is a person because of other people. And Africans share this very strong view of community, that who we are is not only shaped by the community we live in, but it draws its meaning and its value and its significance from the people with whom we live and relate and serve. Another value which has been common, at least everywhere I've been, is hospitality. And I'm going to show a few slides of some of the receptions that I've gotten. It really is true that you can go to almost any village, at least that's far enough away from the road so they're not inundated by visitors, and people will be welcoming of you. They place a very high value in accepting you into their lives, wherever that may be, serving whatever it is they have, which in my area is usually their very strong tea that they drink, 3 cups, which is a wonderful ceremony, and meals and staying overnight and whatever. That's a very high value for them. And I bring that up because it illustrates one of the points I want to make, which is that we have much to learn from Africans. And I think the longer you live there, the more you realize that how many gifts Africans have to offer us. Certainly this hospitality is one of them. Certainly this love for people is one. The knowledge that they have very deep inside them that life is lived as a community. We're not just individuals apart. But as I just said, Africa is a continent about three times the size of the United States, with more than 1,000 languages spoken there. So we obviously have to be very cautious about making generalizations. I'll just add here that the language I'm working on is, I'm working in, to a certain degree, is Pular, which is one of the local languages of Senegal, but even a very small country like Senegal, and you can see how big it is, has 10 fairly widely spoken languages and many more small languages. I can't obviously give much of an introduction to Africa in this session. One of the books that I would recommend reading as a good overview, and maybe many of you already have, is David Lamb's book, The Africans, which I brought along, but I left it back there. Barb, do you have it? Just to show you, I don't even know if it's in the bookstore. It wasn't my favorite book because it gives a very harsh picture of what's happening today in Africa, but it's true. A lot of difficulties are going on in Africa right now. Nations don't seem to be succeeding very well in independence, and we can tend to be very critical. But I think we need to remember that there are no countries that were colonized that have been independent for more than 26 years. And that's not really very long. If we think what was going on in the United States 26 years after 1776, which would make about 1802, I'm not sure that our nation was free of problems either. The other thing that we have to realize is that Africa has always had things taken out of it. For a long time, the main thing taken out of it was people. People taken out as slaves. And that's certainly the greatest resource that Africa has lost to the Western world. But also timber, minerals, agricultural products, as colonization became more important, all these things were taken and really not a lot given back to the people there. Before I turn on the slides too, I want to talk just a little bit about the American Lutheran Church's mission in Africa and in Senegal, and so therefore how I came to be in Senegal. I think many of you know the strength of the Christian Church in Africa. It's the fastest growing Christian church in the world is in Africa. Obviously the mood of missions has changed as countries have become independent and churches have become independent. Missionaries have become servants of the local church rather than sent out simply from here. We work as partners with local churches. Two of the very strong Lutheran churches are found here in Nigeria and Cameroon. And in northern Cameroon and Nigeria, in fact, all across West Africa, there's an ethnic group called the Fulani people in English, or Fulbe in their language. And as Lutherans in those countries began to think about outreach, they began to think about the Fulani people, who are very strongly Muslim, basically 100% Muslim, but they exist in so many countries and they live in such close proximity to Christians that they felt a call to do outreach of some kind to these Fulani people. They're an ethnic group with whom very few organizations had worked. And so they began work there, and then the ALC decided to send missionaries to Senegal also, where we have a very high number of these Fulani people, or there we call them Pular-speaking people. And we've been there for about 10 years now, serving in whatever way we find that we can serve, whether that be in agriculture or health work or now we're getting into some sort of urban ministry, working with a very, very high number of youth that are unemployed in the cities, as one finds in all countries of the third world, basically. And we hope that in this work, in some way, we can be witnesses to what we believe. We, unlike Saudi Arabia, as many of you have probably been hearing with John and Carol Avery's session lately, we are free to be Christians in Senegal. We're free to speak about what we believe, and we hope that God will in some way work through our presence there to reach out and show God's love to the people with whom we work there. So that's how we came to be in Senegal, which is a small country. You can see from the map, unfortunately, there aren't different colors for the different countries, so you'll have to come up afterwards and see really how big Senegal is. It's quite small. It has about 6 million people, which is not real big, but it was a great favorite of the French colonial government. As some of you may remember, the French had two basic large colonies in Africa, French West Africa and French Equatorial Africa. And a city in Senegal was for a very long time the capital of all of French West Africa. They loved it. It has a wonderful climate. And so Dakar, the capital of city of Senegal, has become a very flourishing modern city. But unfortunately, that's not where I work. I work up in the north, where there are fewer resources, much fewer wealth, and people who are really struggling to survive. The main export of the country is peanuts. Probably tourists is the main. No, I believe peanuts is still the number one export. Is that right? But up in the north where I work, it's much too dry to grow even peanuts. And so I'm going to try and show you a little bit about the economy of the Fulani herders, cattle herders of the area, how they've suffered with the drought, which has really gone on since about 1973 in the Sahel. A few good years in between, but basically a lot of bad years, how they are struggling to survive, and how in some way we hope to be ministering there in that very difficult area. So I'm going to turn on the slides now.
If somebody could get the lights, I turned them on over by there was just really, oh, just right by the door. The furthest left. There you are. West Texas? Do we have a lot of wealth like that? Okay, as I was saying, I live in the north of Senegal, what is really the classic Sahel. The Sahel is the area that received a lot of publicity back in 1973-74, where millions and millions of cattle died in the drought, and people's whole lifestyles changed the first time it went without a great deal of rain. In good years, when it rains a good amount, all this area would become green. Grass would grow. But right now, as you can see, it's pretty bleak. But the whole area that I live in is dotted with these small villages, which are centered around wells, because that's the source of water. And one realizes that all life is centered around water there, the lack of it, and what you can do with it. The economy is based on cattle, and the Fulani people are traditionally wonderful herders. They're very, very knowledgeable in cattle, as you can see here, and then in front of that there are sheep and goats. At first glance, and when you first get there, you think they're all goats, but actually some of them are sheep. They just look a lot like goats. The crops traditionally grown in the area are millet and sorghum. But in later years, in recent years, I can say there hasn't even been enough rain to get a good crop of millet, which requires substantially less rain than corn or wheat or anything we're used to growing in the Midwest where I come from. In this land, millet and sorghum are grown in Texas. That must be what you saw resembling. but mainly for cattle feed and bird feed and things like that. The women have a very difficult and arduous task of pounding this millet into flour, which is then steamed to make a sort of couscous. And you know what Moroccan couscous is, it's a steamed dish, which is traditionally served with milk, because as you can see with all those cattle, the one resource that these people do have is milk.
Did you know that we had the grain millet for lunch?
That's excellent. It's very rarely eaten in this country, but you all experience now how good it can be. This is what a typical village looks like. Out in the grasslands, most people build their houses out of grass, which is what this house is in the foreground. A few people who might have a little bit of money could put a coating of cement over mud walls, which is the white house that you see in the background. And this is what a typical village along the river looks like, where they have good clay from the river basin, they would be able to make houses much more easily out of mud. And this is the village that I live in. Mm-hmm. Senegal.
Yeah.
Life is not easy for people, especially during the dry season when they have to travel many miles a day to get water, many of them. Sometimes on the backs of donkeys, or sometimes if they have a little more money, on carts such as this. I think you can recognize what's the container that they use for water there. Old truck inner tubes, which works very well for them. They love filling up their inner tubes at the deep wells that have been dug by the government, and that's their source of water. But most people don't live very near these deep wells. The Fulani people, and I should apologize, I continue to say Fulani people because that's the word in English, the word that's used in Cameroon or Nigeria, but in Senegal we call them the Fulani people, but I'll continue to say Fulani people, are a fascinating people. They're thought to have originated in Ethiopia. I think you can see their features are a little different than many of the black people, more like Ethiopians or different Nilotic from the east coast of Africa. They have migrated west and now live in more countries, I think, than any other ethnic group. They're beautiful people. You can see all the earrings she has. They love jewelry. And this woman's particular mark of beauty is the indigo that's tattooed around her mouth. They think that makes women very beautiful. And even in modern times, though, not so many women do that anymore. It's just because it's too painful, but they still find that a great mark of beauty. And now they usually only tattoo indigo into your gums above your teeth. They have a very rich culture, well adapted to the harsh environmental conditions of the Sahel, like northern Senegal. As you can see, the women are busy pulling water out of the well. They have donkeys for transporting. They've got goats for milk. They've got cattle. It's a real mixed economy, and it works well for them. But since 1973, the rains have not come like they once did. People have cut down far too many trees for firewood as the population increases, and too many cattle have overgrazed the fragile pasture. And sand dunes, which begin to resemble the Sahara Desert, have started to move in many of the villages where I work. I think the sand dunes are beautiful, but they're deadly because absolutely nothing can grow when you have the fine sand like that. It's a big difference from the sand that's normally there, is sand that has a little bit of grassy in it, etc. And as the tree cover lessens, we have more of what you can see here, though not too well, dust storms. We often look up in the summer months, during the rainy season, and see dark clouds, which we hope, of course, will bring rain, but instead it brings thick orange dust. And then all you can do at that point is run inside, shut all your windows, shut all your shutters, and and just wait. There were some dust storms last summer where everything got completely dark for a few minutes. Dark, like darker than night. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face, and that was just dust at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There are more and more camels in the area. Camels aren't native. They're not the traditional animals of the people with which I work. They're more the traditional animals of Mauritanians, which live further up really in the Sahara Desert. But as the environmental conditions change, camels become more important in the local economy. Very difficult time, and people there realize that they need help to change their economic base. They need help on new ways to produce food. And that's where we, American Lutheran Church missionaries, have attempted to help in some way. Since 1981, ALC missionaries have worked with women's groups that were already organized to teach them to garden and to help them with the initial supplies of seeds and watering cans and tools. I just want to say a few words here that the women are more organized in Northern Senegal than I've ever seen in any other place. In every village, large or small, the women tend to be organized into sort of a cooperative association to which they may contribute money each month and then split the money each month, give all the money to one or two women so that she is able to make a large purchase because saving is so difficult in an area like that. So they're well organized, and we've been able to help them get started in a new activity like gardens, which they really appreciated. And I'm going to show quite a few pictures of gardens here. I wanted to point out the man behind Sue Barron, who's an ALC missionary. He's all wrapped up in a turban, which is how the men like to be dressed on dusty days. But with only his sunglasses showing, it does create quite a picture. Gardens are logical in our area, especially along the river, because Njoum, our village, is located on a branch of the Senegal River, which is one of the large rivers of West Africa. It's not fed from the rain. In our area, we wouldn't have nearly enough rain to have a river like that, but it flows up from the south, from Guinea, where they have much more water, and it's really the life source of the area. The way the gardens are watered, at least at this point, is that women go down to the river, fill up their basins, and carry it all up on their heads. And you can imagine in that climate, with the relative humidity much of the time below 5%, I'd say, gardens really need a lot of water to keep them going. So it's very difficult work. The women are strong and hardworking, and it's really been a joy for me to be able to work with them on such projects. I took the gardens over from Bill and Sue Barron, who had been working with some villages, and now I'm working in about 9 villages, or was last year, and which probably totals about 1,000 women. They're pretty large women's associations. The women have to cultivate the ground, add a lot of manure. Manure is one thing that doesn't last, as you can probably see from the number of animals in some of the pictures, plant the seeds, and then water twice a day. This is the cool season, and so they're planting what they like best, which is what European-type vegetables, a lot of cabbage. You may have seen cabbage in many of your pictures. They absolutely love cabbage, can't get enough of it. Tomatoes, lettuce, turnips, carrots, hot peppers. Gardening is still quite new to them since, as I tried to point out, they were traditionally animal raisers, and so they need a lot of help and encouragement. And so I worked with them as well as a young Senegalese man who has worked with us for a number of years and knows gardening very well. These women are particularly good friends of mine, and they've often told me the story about until 1973, they had cattle, but that was the year they lost it all. And so they had to come to a village along the river and settle down.
So they're very excited to develop new techniques which that can help them to survive. And our main goal is that as they learn to grow and enjoy a variety of vegetables, nutrition and health will improve for them and their children. Although, as you can see, that's lettuce that she's holding up, which is not real high on the nutritional list, but potatoes, that's a big one. All that whole row behind them is potatoes, and that garden got very because children grow up quickly in Africa. As you can see, this young girl already has the responsibility of taking care of her younger brother or sister. Work begins early, and that's why I think in particular it's important that the children be well nourished. It's usually the boy's job to tend the goats and the sheep, although not usually on donkey back like this, while the girls help their mother in all the mother's tasks, which are many: pounding, cooking, taking care of other siblings, cleaning up, working in the garden, obviously all the tasks of the mother. Their young children are taught to help from the beginning. We've also worked with some gardens in some villages that are not right along the river, and this obviously makes the task much more difficult since all the water needs to come out of wells, which is an absolutely exhausting job when some of the wells are as much as 150 feet deep hand-dug wells, and they pull the water up in the bucket on a pulley. But the women are really committed to earning money and improving the nutrition for them and their families through gardening. West African women are known throughout the world, especially as Muslim women, for being some of the most independent and the most able to control their own finances. I won't say that it's equality, but women, it's expected that they will have their own money separate from their husband. And so what they can earn is for themselves. But the American Lutheran Church mission is not in Senegal only to help with agriculture and other physical needs. We're trying to do what is called holistic ministry, ministering in whatever way we can. Senegal is a very strongly Islamic country, something like 90% Islamic, with less than 5% Christian. John and Carol Avery have been doing very good introductions to Islam over the past weeks, and so I'm not going to talk too much about Islam, but I do want to remind you that Muslims are very religious people with a very deep reverence for God. And one of their obligations includes praying 5 times a day, and wherever you are, in the market, at school, in the middle of the city, far from anything, tending the goats, people, especially men, will stop, gather together when it's prayer time, and pray together. It's quite a ritual with several different positions as they bend and kneel down and lie down to worship God. The problem with the praying, well, I shouldn't say problem, that's very judgmental, but they pray in Arabic, which very few of them understand, but that's the language of prayer. In Senegal, also, the Islam has its own particular character. African Islam, like African Christianity, is uniquely African. This baby is wearing amulets, which are good luck charms, made from verses of the Quran, the holy book of Islam, written on small pieces of paper and sewn into leather pouches. And that is believed to bring good luck, to protect from evil spirits. And I mentioned that to John Avery, and he said that would be total heresy. That would be absolutely forbidden in Saudi Arabia, where the Islam is a little more orthodox. We believe that the good news that we have to
offer is not only improved agricultural techniques, but the revelation that God is a loving God, a God that has revealed himself in Jesus Christ. This center was built by Finnish missionaries who were working closely together with Finnish Lutherans. This is in a city called St. Louis, which is the old capital of French West Africa, and they're working there. We've also opened a center in Jhelum of a rather more modest nature. In this building, which we've just rented, we plan to do dialoguing of different sorts. We have a library because, though there are many somewhat educated people in our village, they have nothing to read. And then to do different discussions on different topics is what we hope will take place there. I wanted to also point out a recent issue of the magazine World Encounter, which is the ALC Mission magazine. If any of you have encountered it, I don't know. And it's put out by the ALC and the LCA jointly, and anyone can subscribe to it. Anyway, the spring 1986 issue focused on Islam. And there's an article in it by the director of the ALC Mission Division, Mark Thompson, which I think is really helpful. And then there's another article, which is why I brought it up, by a missionary in Senegal writing about tea and theology, which is something that he and his wife do regularly with an Islamic teacher in the village where they live. He points out that much of the best discussed is one of their favorite rituals. He drinks three different glasses of this very strong, very sweet tea. And as they're cooked, each of them separately, it takes about an hour, and a lot of discussion is done. No, I spend much of my day simply interacting with people and responding to their hospitality. As I said, they offer so much to us. We try and offer what we can to them, but certainly wonderful, wonderful hospitality is offered to us by them. It's true that wherever you go, you'll be well received. Now I want to show one particular reception that we had. You don't usually get received this well, but this is an example of the fabulous hospitality that people in a very small village, very out of the way, are capable of. I went with a delegation. It's really the two African men on the far right that are the honored guests, and the rest of us are just sort of along. But they put up a fabulous reception, including dancing, which is certainly an important way of receiving guests in Senegal. Meals are always served. What you can see there is the Senegalese way of eating millet, a little different than the Holden Village way, but also delicious. Meals are usually served in large bowls, and everyone gathers around and eats either with your hands or with your cane. And the food there is excellent for the most part, I think. Traditional entertainers can entertain you. The culture is very rich and has great beauty and great joy to offer to the Westerners as they show what community spirit and hospitality can really mean. Unfortunately, and I'm going to move away from our work just for a minute, to say that this great hospitality on the part of Senegalese has not always been returned by Westerners. One of the saddest places to visit in Senegal, but I think very important for all of us to be aware of, is a place called Gore Island. It's just off the coast of Dakar, and it was from this island that a very high percentage of all the slaves that came to America set foot in Africa for the last time. It's still a museum. Oops, backwards. This place called the Maison des Esclaves, or the Slave House. So picturesque in some ways. You can see the horror of life that went on to these slaves as they awaited their ship to leave forever for America.
They were captured all along the West African coast and were brought here until to be processed and then were sold. And it's through this door that they said goodbye to Africa for the very last time. And it's a very moving experience to go there, especially with some with Black Americans as I have been, to remind us of the horror that has gone on in European and African relations. Africa is a land of great contrast. Here you see modern transportation, modern vans, but overcrowded, late, and fairly disorganized. That's the contrast. This is one of our favorite things about our program, to include this. Fence is made out of whatever material they can find. Yes, now can anyone guess what these fences are made out of? That's right. I was going to say, it might help if you know that about 95% of Senegalese are constantly wearing shoes like this. Like I have on, and they're actual shoes from Senegal, and that's from the factory that they're made in. They're stamped out of those. Sheets, the rubber-bound sheets. Rubber-bound sheets, and they use them for fences. Africa, or Senegal is Islam, but Islam was a very particularly African flavor. The people are beautiful, warm, friendly, deeply reverent of God. They know God. This is the mother's channel I live in. And the women, most of all, is anyone's impressions of Africa. The women are extremely hardworking. They always do, even when it's really hot. So these particular slides were taken, it wasn't very hot, but that's just their tradition. Lots of clothing, very colorful, beautiful clothing. But even with these hardworking people live in extremely harsh environmental conditions. And in a way, we realize that we live in a different world. But we hope that through working together in the garden, dialoguing together, as we do what we can do in education. This is a literacy class, and we're not actually working in literacy yet, but that's something that we really want to focus on in Senegal. Teaching people to read and write in their local language to our. We hope that on all these things, as we work together, that there will be more of trust built up between us Westerners, Western Christians, and these Senegalese Muslims. Before I close, I just want to talk a little bit about my living situation. So my friends, this is my house. It's quite a small house, made of cement blocks. And that's my car out in front, in my carport, as I call it. So I have a very nice car and not such a nice house in which to spend the 110 or 115 degree days. But what I especially enjoy here is that I'm in the compound of a Senegalese family, who I show some of in this next picture. And they've really become a family to me, accepting me in, having me over for meals as often, basically whenever I want to eat with them. And in turn, of course, I bring them what I can. And really being a family together with them. And I was very happy that Barbara came to visit me there. And so here I have some American family and some Senegalese family all mixed together. She came to visit in about 2 weeks in January. These are mostly her slides, so that's why we're all dressed warm. In January, it is cool. In early June, when I left, end of May, it got up to 110 degrees every day, down to a cool 95 degrees or so for the night. So it's nice to see the whole for a change. One of my favorite people in the family is this little boy, Mamadou. He's it was a special friend of mine, and so I want to close with reflecting that what we're doing there is very long-term. Sometimes it seems like it's small steps. We're all growing. I'm learning a lot from the people there, the warm, friendly, hardworking people there, and I hope that in some way I can offer something that maybe someday will bring more hope for the lives of children like this.
All right.
And have a better life.
That's all that I had planned to say, so I'm certainly open to whatever questions you might have, and I don't have my watch with me. I also want to point out that Elizabeth, right, was working in Senegal very amazingly. We found each other on the bus coming up, and she's worked as a Peace Corps volunteer for 2 years, just down the road from me. Really, it's surprising. So she can certainly answer some questions, too. It's one of the technologies that is often brought up as an appropriate technology, and frankly, I think it has possibilities, because in our area, the big meal is eaten at noon. In much of Africa, in Zaire, where I worked before, the major meal was done in the evening, so it wasn't much good to have the cooker that only works in the hot sun. Basically, it's an expensive and cumbersome technology, at least what I've seen so far, to concentrate. Most of the ones I've seen are a big parabolic cooker where the pot is concentrated in the focus of the parabola, and it only allows you to cook one pot at a time, and they need several pots. So that's what I think one of the reasons why they haven't been introduced. I don't know. What do you think? I think the work that's being done more by Peace Corps and other people are improved wood stoves, so that the same amount of wood can be used to cook more food. And these stoves can be built out of local mud and sand, and so it seems to be an easier one to introduce to a wider number of people.
Have you ever seen solar cookers?
No, the last cook stoves. They cut down. They were purchased very locally to get all the materials and very expensive.
But you're certainly right in saying that one thing they have is sun. And I was without electricity for my first year there, but just 2 weeks before I left here, I got a solar panel, photovoltaic. And so now I have a few lights and, best of all, a fan, which makes it a lot more livable to get through those hot nights especially. So I'm really excited about that. And I think that's an idea that we could work on in the future. Fortunately, I'm going to be there for at least 5 years. So there's time to work on other things. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't really look before. Who
would next? The economic situation, the family you said has a compound. Do you rent that house? Do they give it to you? Or what does that family do? We didn't see any men in the family. Where are they?
Oh, the father of the family is a retired fireman from Dakar, and actually he served in the French Army before that. Many Senegalese men were in the French Army in World War II. I don't know if anyone was aware of that. I certainly wasn't until I went there. But there was a very large number of African soldiers in the French Army, often sent to the most difficult spots. But anyway, that's his past. He's there, but I rent the house. It cost me about $40 a month. So that seems like a reasonable cost.
So
he
has a French retirement.
Somewhat. I don't know what the there is something from that, yeah. Yeah.
But
yes, I think that any society, especially when it's capitalist as Senegal, would would separate itself out into the wealthy and the poor. Though Senegal is ruled, or has the party that has been elected to power for the last 26 years is the Socialist Party. They're an extremely capitalist country, in fact. But it seems to work fairly well for them. The classes that I would bring up, I guess, is that it's a casted society. People are born into a certain job, like blacksmith or woodcarver, or the sort of nobles who don't have a particular job, or slaves. And there are still people who are known and who know themselves to be slaves, although they're not slaves actually. They don't work for anyone, but they're still called slaves. So people are born into a certain class, but that doesn't determine how wealthy they are. As a matter of fact, some of the former slaves are the wealthiest people in the village. They work themselves up.
Yeah. Where is the main growing season? Is that like spring and fall?
It's summer, August to October. And so when I go back now in July, we'll be preparing for the rainy season. And what I'm hoping to work with at that point is planting trees in and around villages and relying on at least reasonable rains to be able to water them, and the people will water them in addition. We work with these same women's cooperatives. So I have to hurry back in July, and by the end of July, there should be some rain. If God is willing, as they end every sentence with, practically. Any sentence in which you talk about the future, and I think this is in any Islamic society, you add, inshallah, if God is willing, because you don't know if there will be rain. You don't know if there will be a growing season. It depends on God.
Who organized this women, and what ways do the development agencies exploit them?
The women in the villages where I worked, like I say, have organized themselves. And this is not just, well, there will be some villages maybe where they weren't organized before they found out that they could get help to start a garden. But in the majority, there was already an association. But in recent years, those associations have been helped by many development organizations. For example, one innovation is motorized milling machines to mill the millet so that women don't have to pound and pound and pound for hours. They've got small millet machines, and a village together could operate and manage a machine. Each person would pay a certain amount for the millet that she had ground, and those are usually organized by women too. The women were already organized, basically, and we tend to stay out of any of the election of officers or how they want to split up the profit of their cooperative. It's their money, although they do have needs, I think, in terms of improved bookkeeping methods and perhaps better marketing techniques. I think there could be some work there. But we consider ourselves to be, I don't know, outside consultants or something like that to help them in gardening techniques and help them procure the necessary materials to do what they want to do, which is gardening.
Do you foresee any problems coming up with increased better diets, more people? Do you see the land supporting more people, or where are the dynamics of that?
Yeah, that is a tough one, because frankly I don't see the land supporting more people. I don't know what will change. And it's an issue that there are a lot of issues I constantly struggle with. Life is a struggle, but that's certainly one of them. But I think any Christian would believe that each person is a child of God and must be helped in whatever way we can. The land in my area is barely supporting the people that are there now. I don't see how it can support more people. But I guess there's the possibility of increased urbanization, increased industrialization that could lead to other outputs. I don't know, I'm not being very articulate here. I don't know if other people would like to respond to that. What is our response as Christians in response to
overpopulation or to increase population in areas where the land is really almost at its limit.
Do they have a population program for birth control available?
I would say that that is an extremely sensitive area in any Muslim country. Senegal may be less than some. There is an organization in conjunction with Planned Parenthood, as a matter of fact, that talks very, very gently about spacing births. Because you never talk about limiting the number of births, but encouraging people to put a bigger space between their kids, which obviously limits kids, but that just is not talked about. But obviously has to. It has to be someday. And the question is what day that can be and by who. Because even the doctors, the best educated people in our town were horrified when I talked about that one day. They just said, absolutely, absolutely not. Children are the will of God. I mean, children are a gift of God. We don't limit them. Not something we do. It's a very tough issue.
How many births does it usually have to go through?
Probably 8.
Birth rate then?
I don't know the birth rate. Well, it must be.
You have 8. You know, all of them.
Yeah, I take my family as typical. There were 8 children and 4 are alive. I think that's
really
typical.
What happens, I think, are statistics that show that as food production goes up per person, birth rate decreases. So, I mean, if there's a, what you're doing is going to change the nature. If they have gardens and food, and that's one thing our country needs to learn something a little bit more. We have fat, very generous, but we need to learn more about giving the advantages of our abundance.
That's really true, and I think also as economic conditions improve enough so that young people have some sort of hope for the future.
Education, you're doing that, but also another education.
They can in some way control their lives and see other meaning in life besides simply having kids. But the world is not short on food. It's simply some areas, and obviously we're learning more and more as rich Christians.
I want to ask some questions on the fences. I assume the fences are keeping on living there.
Yes, that's the problem. Everything needs to be fenced because the animals are not fenced. So anything else you want has to be fenced. They wander. Barb?
Well, I was just going to make one comment about that population thing. I think this is one place, too, where you see how vast and varied the continent of Africa is. It appears that there is an overpopulation problem perhaps in West Africa, but in much of Central Africa, there's an underpopulation problem in Cameroon, in Zaire, in Central African Republic. So, and overall, Africa is certainly not overpopulated. There are some countries that are very populous, Nigeria, Kenya, Senegal, but that, you know, that's something that can't be generalized to all countries in Africa, and I think it's something that we Americans too often turn to as another one of the problems of Africa, which isn't so widespread as we tend to think. Africa is really varied on that whole question of population. And indeed in Zaire and some other countries, there's a lot of empty land just sitting there that needs to be populated.
Geographic, right? There's a socio-geographic that will not attract people in this country. In other words, where we have great overpopulation not attracting with underpopulation unless they can find some reason for going. South America is an example of creating in-migration, but because they have the natural resources. Some of the means to take an in-migration of people. I mean, that's why people are swarming into America from all over the world. I mean, because we have the ability to, whatever the population stands for anywhere, to sustain it to some degree. I think Africa cannot do it unless they have technology and education to develop a reason for going, for bringing people there, or South Africa.
certainly the land has greater potential than what it's producing right now. But we have to be very careful, I think, in a place as ecologically fragile as this area where I live, to not bring in technologies that are in the end harmful. It's a very fragile place. Now, Elizabeth was working with fish culture. Do you want to say just a couple words about it?
Yeah, I was working with mostly men in contrast to your work. Men were not as well organized. They formed cooperatives. They were very unwilling to donate any money for the benefit of anybody else. That was one thing that seemed to be pretty unique to women, that kind of cooperation. The fish culture was in response to a dam that was being built by
Arabs. Isn't the Arabs in France?
No, World Bank was financing a lot of organizations, but the dam was going to be built in Mali, and the result was that it would flood the Senegal River to a level that would wipe out a lot of the natural agriculture in the area. So they were trying to, and also would wipe out the natural breeding places of the fish that lived there. So fish was one of the very few sources of protein that we could have, animal protein. So we were trying to introduce this program with those fish. And it was just the very beginning. It's too hard to say. Like I said, most programs are so long-term, it's very difficult to say what will happen. But the results won't be seen before the dam, of course. So I had some real concerns about development agencies coming in and building this dam, which is going to wipe out most of the natural agriculture, quite a range of the people have access to. And it would make them much more dependent on the land that they're already getting. That's why the gardens are very important too, because they usually build up near the village and away from the level that would be flooded by the dam. Do you know the progress is still on the dam?
The dam 87. Things are in change, and I think that's I guess what I tried to point out with the drought, and certainly bringing up the dam is important. It's an area in transition, all of us that work there are really struggling to find ways to make that, to help people through that transition, because their lives are being uprooted, changed totally in this decade, really.
Who's the dam going to help?
We're
going to
help. We're going to help Western Kansas. They want to get, there's a lot of reasons they say, but there's a lot of mineral deposits in Mali that they would like to have year-round transportation. The underlying.
Well, also what it's going to do is level out the level of the river, which at this point floods in one season and then almost dries up. And so you can't do good irrigated agriculture with pumps because there isn't enough water during the dry season. And what it'll do is make that possible throughout the year. But what it also does is wipe out the flood recession agriculture, which is a much lower technology, much more sure, I mean, much easier.